Hi everyone, my name is Bryce Rankins, and you're listening to Episode 7 of Sneaky Geek.
Than a speeding bullet, more powerful than a locomotive, able to leap tall buildings at a single bound. Look, up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane, it's Superman!
What up, everybody? My name is Bryce Rankins, and Brian Romero is out today, but I am here today with Dave Ziegler.
Hi!
Now, this is a podcast, and you didn't see Dave's jazz hands, but they were fabulous.
You know, I've noticed, because this is, from my perspective, the third, fourth thing that I've recorded with you guys, I always do the jazz hands.
Well,
I don't know why.
We'll have to get a photo of it and put it on something eventually.
Well, if you guys launch a Patreon, that can be one of your incentives.
Fair. Yeah, you get a photo of Dave.
Put it on a coffee mug.
Dave and I are here today to talk about the Golden Age, the Silver Age, and the Bronze Age of comics.
Absolutely.
Now, I'm coming at this from a comic perspective of a guy who really got into American comics in the late 90s.
Okay.
The only thing that I know regarding these various ages are that they are defined by their years that took place, mm-hmm. as well as certain trends within the comics that are not necessarily defined by them, but they come up.
Yeah.
So, All-Star Superman.
Grant Morrison and Frank Quitely.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And
love that series, by the way.
It's great. Yeah. I have, you know, a few issues with it, but one of the first issues that I had with it was this sort of anything goes in the writing,
mm-hmm.
which is how somebody like Jimmy Olsen not only is CEO for a day, air quotes, but when shit hits the fan, they're like, you're the CEO for the day. Like, that's how it would go down.
Like, what are we going to do? Like, CEO for the day?
Yeah, like, you handle this, you know, CEO for the day on our moon base.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a little absurd.
Right.
And the first thing that was said to me after that was, well, that's Silver Age comics for you.
That is an accurate assessment. Okay. So, well, let me ask you this first. Is this just a curiosity standpoint? Like, what's our goal for this conversation? Because as I understand the mission of Sneaky Geek, it's to basically throw open the gates.
Yeah,
yeah?
For sure.
So what are we doing here? Convincing people, hey, read comics? Or is this just sort of...
Well, one of the big gates, I think, that shows up with comic books is a lack of understanding of the history of comic books regularly is used as a gatekeeping method. People are like, oh,
okay.
Well, if you don't know about this and this timeline,
okay.
You're not a true comic book fan.
Okay,
you
fair.
Know, only true comic book fans know about blah, blah, blah. And
I hate that bullshit.
We all do. That's why this podcast is here.
Dig it. Okay.
So when that happens, there's two reactions you can have. You can either go, well, screw you then, I don't want to be a part of this, which is a regular response, or you can go research it. And unfortunately, the first person who probably would be willing to tell you about it is that a-hole who just told you that you should know about it.
Right.
And you're obviously not going to get the info from them.
Because he's a douchebag.
Because he's a douchebag. So instead of throwing open the gates in this episode, we're more giving them a couple of keys.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
I personally don't have a lot of experience with older comics aside from having read a few things from various classic comic books.
Sure.
But
if I had to guess, I'd be willing to bet some American Folding money that most of those classic comic books are from the last 20 years, 30 years.
Probably the last 40 is about as early as I go.
Okay.
A lot of it was early Starlin era.
Okay.
So
all right. Yeah, that's definitely 70s.
70s, 80s.
Mm-hmm.
I have almost the entire Beard Thor saga.
The Walt Simonson stuff?
Yeah, when he gets
God.
Swapped out. The only ones I'm missing are the ones where he teams up with somebody else and they're on the cover.
Oh.
So I have every solo issue that bearded Thor up until the Infinity Gauntlet.
Well, there. Okay, so some
Actually
of that...
past the Infinity
Some Gauntlet. Of that is after, well after
yeah,
Simonson.
Yeah.
But...
basically up until Thor... the clean shaven long blonde hair Odin's son comes back.
Okay, so I have that. So you've got like Thunderstrike and all that sort of thing?
I believe so. There were like 50 cents on a Black Friday thing. So I just was like, well, I guess I'm spending $40 to get this entire arc and series of arcs. It was cool.
Yeah.
But that's about as early as I go.
Some of that is 80. Most of that is actually, that segment in Thor was like in the 90s. So yeah, but still, you've got a, it's all pretty recent for you, I guess, relatively.
Yeah, when there was still lots of words, when there was, and not as many like full page spreads.
Yes, yes.
Back when there's a lot of narration.
Sure, still. And back when an artist would do 2 or 3 books a month.
Yeah.
Because that's what he had to do to put food on the table.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I say lots of words. I'm not like, oh, there's too many words in this book. I mean, like, it's the dialogue is a lot more. The dialogue explains more than the pictures do.
Yeah, a combination of telling and showing.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
So that's about as far back as I go. I mean, I read V for Vendetta cover to cover.
Right.
And I really enjoyed
it. Brilliant work.
I loved it. What year is V for Vendetta?
Thatcher's England. It was published from September of 88 to May of 89.
You know, V for Vendetta, that's my non-American comic book, you know, for the whole collection. But yeah, generally speaking, about the last 40 years.
Okay. All right. So then let's just go back to the beginning.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So first of all, these ages are generally tied to superhero comics. Okay. We had comics before we had superhero comics, but a lot of them were reprints. We have what's called like the Platinum Age before the Golden Age. Reprints of newspaper strips, things like that. The Spirit supplements from Will Eisner. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Will Eisner is an iconic name in comic books. Not to go on a massive tangent, but
a slight tangent.
He literally wrote the book on comics.
He was certainly he was an artistic innovator in ways that a large portion of the business is still catching up with.
Yeah.
And he was hugely influential. And we're not really going to talk much about Will in this one.
No.
So, May 1938 is when we see the first issue of Action Comics number 1.
Okay.
That was a dumb way to say it. The first issue of Action Comics number 1. That's when Action Comics number 1 hits the stands.
Yeah.
Action Comics number 1 is notable because it's the first appearance of Superman.
Right.
From
Zold in the car.
Exactly. Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. And it was like a bomb going off because it was the first time we had a superpowered comic book character. Okay. We had had characters like Superman in the pulps. For those of you who don't know what pulps are, there's like they're called pulps because of the cheap paper they were printed on.
Oh,
you know,
and pulp paper.
Exactly. And that's where we have characters like Doc Savage, the Shadow, the Spider. Characters that are, they're normal dudes. I mean, except for Doc Savage, but he wasn't a superhero like Superman.
Right.
Okay. He was just a little bit better than regular humans, you know. So we get Superman and it's a smash hit. He was also just one feature in the book because comic books were anthologies then.
Right. You get magazines. I mean,
multiple features in the book. Yeah.
Several short stories, like 3 to 4.
Action Comics number 1, I think, was 64 pages.
Oh my gosh.
So you had a ton of stories in there.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. So, well, that was really common in the Golden Age. Right. Plus, the page sizes were bigger.
Okay.
Like if you were to look at Golden Age sized storage bags versus silver and modern sized bags,
right,
they're bigger. They're notably bigger than silver and modern. Action Comics number 1 was huge. Everyone's starting to get into the superhero game. Fawcett Comics comes up with Captain Marvel, who we know today as Shazam. I think it was Centaur Comics that published Wonder Man, and DC sued them out of existence because it was too much like Superman. There was a long lawsuit with Fawcett, too, which has ramifications with modern-day Marvel comics, but that's probably a different podcast. Okay. It kind of comes around into a sort of winding, meandering path to get there.
Gotcha.
So we're not going to talk about that today because it's not relevant to the current topic.
Certainly.
But that's certainly one we can come back to later because it's really interesting.
And regarding the Golden Age, I just want to be clear, Superman, Shazam, or
Captain Marvel.
Captain Marvel, mm-hmm. as he is. Mm-hmm. These are not under DC yet, right?
Superman is.
Superman is under actual.
Superman is under DC.
Schuster and.
Well, it was called National Periodical Publications at the time.
Okay,
but the trade dress was DC.
Now, does that mean that it is being published by them, mm-hmm. or does that? Or, of course, it does. But does that mean that it is not only being published by them, but they are also going to keep this within the same universe? Or does that crossover really not start
Oh, that's not even a thing yet.
Yeah,
that's not a thing yet. It's going to become a thing shortly. We've got this with Superman. It was such a hit that, of course, they wanted more.
Right.
And so that's when we get Batman in Detective Comics 27. Okay.
We didn't include the Batman until the 27th issue of Detective Comics.
Well, that was just a year later.
Right. And Detective Comics 27 was also an amalgam like of
another anthology.
60-ish pages. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So he was just one story in there.
Again, just one story.
That is so cool.
Yes. And what's...
And it explains the number situation a lot better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because today, with publishers today, try to keep things... They relaunch everything.
Right.
All the time. Marvel's particularly bad about this. DC's been less bad, but Marvel really has been bad about this. At the time, there was no interest in that for a couple of reasons. Not the least of which was it was generally considered, or the prevailing belief at the time, was that if your magazine is of a lower number, then it's not going to be around for long.
Yeah.
So you wanted a book with staying power. The higher the numbers, the better.
Right. And people are regularly throwing away these things, so relaunching isn't.
Oh yeah. There's the rule of thumb in those days was every 3 to 5 years your readership turns over completely. The idea of a comic book collector, like I'm 46 years old. The idea of a 46-year-old man in 1938 reading comics for fun would have been laughable. People would have thought there was something wrong with me.
And then at the end of the book, they're going to set you down next to the river and tell you you're going to get a little place.
I see what you did there. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know.
And it's turning over because when you're old enough to read it, and actually mm-hmm. mature enough to handle the content, per se. Not that it's that dark, but...
They were intended for kids.
Yeah, but when you get to that point, you're going to be like, what, 8? And then you're going to be too old for it when you're about 14 and trying to figure out where you're going to get your first job.
Well, once you... The stereotype kind... I don't know if it's a stereotype, I guess. But the theory was, once you discover girls, what do you need comics for? You're going to spend your time and your money on the girls.
Yeah.
Plus, you read your comics, you don't save them. I mean, you roll it up into your back, stick it in your back pocket, ride your bike over to the next block, and trade with the guys over there.
Yeah.
And then maybe you draw a mustache and a beard on Lois Lane.
Right.
You know, you color in it. You cut. You know, there were send-away coupons, so you cut out the coupons.
Those send-away coupons are in there all the way until...
Oh, yeah.
Like 80s and 90s. I mean, I've bought comic books, used comic books when I was a kid that had like coupons and stuff.
Sure.
Still in them.
Exactly. The main reason that a book like Action Comics number 1, you know, sells for $4 million is because of scarcity. Finding an issue complete in good condition is hard. Hell, finding an issue complete in shitty condition is hard.
Yeah.
Because there was no reason to save them.
Right.
There was no concept that these things would ever be worth anything.
Right. Pulp paper, too. It's falling apart.
Yeah, it's cheap paper. And paper drives in World War II.
Yep.
Comics were rife with that. And then we get into the 50s with the Senate hearings on comic books, mm-hmm. Which led to the creation of the Comics Code Authority.
You know, right.
And Estes Kefauver was a senator, and he led those hearings. And between...
Can we talk about that a little bit? Because I don't know very much about that.
Yeah, we can talk about that. So
just to finish off this early age, we've got anthology books
mm-hmm.
made with pulp paper.
Mm-hmm.
They're easily thrown away.
And
the stories are one of many within that book. And the character may not be established within Action Comics, Detective Comics.
Right. Like that, you know, the first Superman story was repurposed panels from the newspaper strip because Siegel and Schuster tried to syndicate it. Because, man, back in those days, syndicated comics was where the action was. Comic books was slumming.
Oh, really?
You know, oh, yeah. The big money was in syndicated comic strips.
Yeah, right.
If you got syndicated, man, I mean, that's where the action was. Because you had guys,
Action Comics was.
Oh, I see what you did there. But you had some of the best artists of the day, you know, in a variety of styles. You had adventure strips with Hal Foster's Prince Valiant or Alex Raymond's Flash Gordon.
Prince Valiant.
You had George Harriman's Crazy Cat, which is the surreal sort of, you know, postmodern before it was postmodern, before that even existed, you know.
Art usually is where that starts.
Yeah. And then, you know, things like Gasoline Alley kind of slice of life, you know, real time sort of stuff. So you had all these different styles, all these different long lasting comic strips. And like I said, that's where the money was. If you could get syndicated, man, you were made.
Does Action Comics number 2 also have Superman in it?
It does, but not on the cover. Superman doesn't become the regular cover feature of Action Comics until, I think, 19.
Okay, but he does stay as a regular recurring character. Did Batman manage to have that same luck? Or did he
in Detective Comics?
Yeah,
Detective Comics.
As soon as he was there, he was a staple?
Mm-hmm.
That's cool. That's really cool. That explains why they got so popular.
Wonder Woman with Sensation Comics number 1.
Okay.
By the time we get to Sensation, you had several superhero characters showing up in that book. Mr. Terrific, Wildcat, obviously Wonder Woman, and so on. So
now this is all taking place in the 30s?
30s, and Sensation, I think, is 1940.
Because as I had always known it, I mean, not to go backwards in time, but as I had always known it, Schuster and Siegel were two Jewish guys in, like, the Bronx or something.
Cleveland, actually.
Cleveland, okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, they were in Ohio.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I had always understood that they were in, like, New York.
The bulk of the industry was from New York. Will Eisner was a New York guy. Jack Kirby was a New York guy. Stan Lee was a New York guy.
You don't really see many cities depicted other than New York in the Depression era. So
well, no, that's true.
That's probably where this happened for me. Mm-hmm. It's just a simple, let's go back to our stock footage in our brain of Depression era city.
Well, and let's face it, Metropolis looks kind of like New York. Lots of skyscrapers, tall buildings. It's got its kind of not so good neighborhoods. So I get that. Although, interestingly, the theory is that they based Metropolis more on Toronto.
Really?
Well, they're both Canadian.
I always assumed that Metropolis was Chicago and that Gotham was New York. But now that I'm learning about crime statistics of current day, I think it's the other way around.
What I've always suspected, and keep in mind that pretty much all of the cities that exist in the real world also exist in the DC universe.
Yeah, there's a New York.
There is
well
a New York.
As a Gotham.
Well, Metropolis was the big apricot.
There it is.
Yeah, there it is.
Don't get me wrong. I love Chicago. It's my favorite city. I think it's
my
one of the
kind
greatest
of town.
I think it's a great one of the greatest cities in the world.
I concur with that assessment.
It is definitely not without its crime problems.
No.
And kind of seedy. It's also the birth of the skyscraper.
Yeah.
You know, the birthplace of the skyscraper is Chicago. So when I think Gotham, I think I can't see the sun. Because there's so many dang buildings. But, I mean, I guess New York's got that, too.
See, yeah. I was, when I was younger, before I started doing all this reading and, you know, all that sort of thing, I always felt like Metropolis was more like New York. You know, the city of tomorrow, the city where anything can happen.
Yep.
And Gotham was more like someplace in New Jersey.
Ah. So they're like,
I mean, because let's face it, Gotham City seems to have a preponderance of chemical factories.
That's fair.
Maybe that's not fair to New Jersey.
Sorry, Jersey.
Yeah, but there it is.
Okay, so getting back on topic. Sensational Comics comes out in the 40s.
Sensation Comics comes out in 1942.
Okay, wow. Okay. We are right there.
Yeah,
we've got a woman clad in American colors.
Well, yeah, and if we can talk about William...
Star-spangled butt.
About William Moulton Marston and Harry Peters. Harry Peters was the artist.
There is a movie coming out.
Yes, that talks about Marston and his unique relationship.
Yes.
Because he was part of a triad. I think that's the term. Is that the term for it?
I mean, I'll let it slide.
We'll use that as the term. If that's not the right term, hit us up on the tweeters.
At Sneaky Geek Pod.
At Mr. Dave Ziegler.
Or at Bryce Rankins. Either way, complain as much as you need to. So,
or say, hey, good job, guys.
Yeah. So he was part of a triad. And there's, you know, the various depictions of her tied up.
It's interesting because Marston was big into the idea that, hey, if we just all submit to women, the world's going to be a better place. And he also had a thing for bondage. They say, write what you know, I guess. I guess.
It's called Professor Marston and the Wonder Women. And it'll be out in theaters on October 13th. In 2017.
Which is not an endorsement, just a statement of fact.
Yeah. If you're interested, give it a whirl. I have only seen a trailer.
That's more than I've seen, but I'm certainly intrigued. I've read a few things about Dr. Marston. He invented the lie detector test, which ties in with Wonder Woman in The Lasso of Truth.
How cool is that?
Super cool.
That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
What? What? That is so cool.
Indeed,
he invented his own lasso of truth.
Yeah,
that's great. And he didn't even. And what does it do? You don't get strapped in to do that, do you?
Well, they attach sensors to you to track your body's physiological responses.
I'm just wondering if there's a bondage aspect to it.
Light bondage, I guess.
I mean, you are kind of being held there.
It's nothing that you can't break out of.
That's fair. But I mean, carrying on. So you have this. Does this come into play in what is about to happen in the 50s that we've alluded to?
I'm
talking about the fact that this is written by a man in a polyamorous relationship with two women who is clearly a bondage enthusiast based on some of the themes of his comics.
Does
any of that come into play as far as scandal?
Interestingly, not so much. I think the big part of it was that most people weren't really aware of that. The idea that we can get, like, reach out and converse with the people who create the art that we enjoy, the actors in the shows that we watch, things like that, that's really new. That is definitely a 21st century phenomenon. When I was a kid, I would write fan letters to my favorite comics, but most of the time, I wouldn't know if anybody had actually read them unless they got published.
Yeah,
so,
you don't know if they've been seen or not.
Yeah, so...
My friend Paula in high school, she got her fan art put into an issue of Fruits Basket, the manga Fruits Basket.
Really?
And issue 4 of Fruits Basket has a drawing of two of the main characters by Paula Gerhold from Bakersfield, California.
Well, that's
Shout
awesome.
Out to Paula, who now translates for Square Enix or something like that over in Japan. Like, she's a badass. She's such a badass.
She's parlayed that fandom into a career.
Into a career, which is wonderful.
That's the dream, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Why do you think I'm here? But, you know, that's the only way we knew that it had... seen anybody, like it had been seen by anybody,
right?
You know, otherwise it was
just at the dawn of the internet. You know,
I've had celebrities like my tweets and it's like, you don't even have to respond to it. You've just said, I mean, you've basically said, I acknowledge this and I approve. And that's such a new, crazy, like, hey, this person heard my thought for a second in under 140 characters.
I will tell you, I am a grown ass man. I have held each of my newborn children in my hands. I have watched the sun rise over the Grand Canyon. I have seen and done some pretty cool shit, and yet I still geek out when my favorite writer or one of my favorite artists comments on one of my Facebook posts.
Yeah.
Totally nerds! You know? So, but anyway,
it's become part of the industry for them as well.
And yeah.
That's how I can run into somebody like Mark Waid, mention you, and he can go, oh yeah, the teacher guy. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And we can like have a brief connection over somebody.
Over
that
random third party that he probably, that he couldn't pick out of a lineup, but occasionally remembers, oh yeah, that guy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's really cool.
Yeah.
Anyway, so here we are at a point where we're not necessarily having too much scandal with artists because they're not as connected as they are now to their work, because they're not part of the brand so much.
Right, and a lot of times they're not even identified in the books.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't until we start to get into the...
Stan soapbox.
Stan Lee, and I think Marvel was really the first one to start identifying the creative teams.
Sure. So let's move to the
Comics Code Authority?
Yeah, Comics Code Authority. Let's move to that. We're deep into it, and we only have a little bit. Actually, we're right about a third of how far we want
to
go.
Okay. So we're going to jump ahead to, well, we can't jump too far ahead because we got to cover a couple more things for the Golden Age.
Okay.
So superhero comics are huge from Superman up through World War II for obvious reasons. The Nazis are a convenient villain. We get the first Captain America during World War II, along with Submariner and the Human Torch from Marvel, except they're not really Marvel yet. They're like Atlas.
Yeah. And so, it's not the Human Torch that you know.
Right. It's the
Android Human Torch, which I feel like has been...
We've seen the Android Human Torch in the Marvel Cinematic Universe because he's in that first Captain America film, Captain America the First Avenger.
Really?
He's a display at the World's Fair.
That's a little sad. but also kind of awesome. Mm-hmm. I would have loved that.
It's super cool. But once we get to the end of World War II, superheroes become less popular. Not sure why. You know, and by the time we get to the end of World War II, we've had superhero teams. We've had the Justice Society of America, okay, which was the first superhero team.
That's cool.
Yeah.
And then we have Captain America's team.
The All Winners Squad.
Is that what they're called?
Mm-hmm. I think that, yeah.
Is Bucky on that?
Yes.
Cool.
Bucky doesn't take the big dirt nap until, that's a retcon, a continuity implant. So, but we've got the Seven Soldiers of Victory, also from DC. But once we get to World War II, superheroes become less popular, sales start to slide, so we get...
I wonder if that has to do with, again, I'm just throwing out random hypotheses, sure, but I mean, that could have to do with birth rates during the Depression. That could have to do with how real the world got for a lot of young guys. Maybe they didn't want superheroes for a while. That could have to do with the writing. Like, there's a million reasons.
Well, I think one of the important reasons for our purposes is the rise of television.
Oh, yeah.
Because television starts to become a thing in homes.
Right.
You know, instead of having to settle for a Saturday at the matinee, the movies, for your moving picture fix, well, now it's in your house.
Yeah, watch radios are smaller and more affordable. Televisions are becoming affordable.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say you can watch it whenever you want, but you can watch it whenever you want as long as something was being broadcast.
Yeah.
And a lot of what was being broadcast was Westerns.
Yeah.
And that became popular in the comics. Once we get to the end of World War II, superheroes kind of fall off the cliff. They're not selling as much or selling as well, I guess. And we start transitioning into other genres, largely because of things like TV.
Right.
You know, right. TV is becoming popular, was certainly more affordable. And what's popular on TV? Westerns.
Right.
So a lot of the comics are dealing with Westerns. They're comic versions of Western shows. DC had, and Marvel both, created original Western characters. Even All-Star Comics, the home of the Justice Society, the first ever superhero team, becomes All-Star Western with issue 56, 57, I think.
Okay.
So...
Because you want to continue,
you want to continue your existing number. Because
low numbers don't sell well, at least as it becomes the 30s.
Exactly. It becomes All-Star Western, and it continues on.
As it was.
Mm-hmm.
Got it.
Yeah.
Is this why the first occurrence of... Now, this is jumping ahead, but is this why the first occurrence of Power Man and Iron Fist together and where they like originally meet is like issue 51 or 50?
The short answer is yes.
Okay. Because I have that.
Mm-hmm.
And
so do I.
It's apparently worth like $100.
It's worth quite a few bucks.
I paid a dollar.
Nice.
I saw it in Blast Off and I was like, I have that comic.
Well, you know,
I have that comic.
Condition and stuff is important. And
I think I've got
that.
Some bumped corners, but like, yeah. I guarantee you, like, it wasn't worth a dollar.
Right. Dig it.
And it's good.
Yeah.
Like, it's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
So this is how that sort of thing happens.
Right. And so then we come to the 50s and comics are just kind of chugging along. And from a superhero standpoint, you've got Superman, you've got Batman and Robin, and you've got Wonder Woman.
And they're living, thriving, going strong.
Yeah.
What's happening over at Marvel?
Marvel is doing science fiction and monster stuff and Westerns.
This is Tales.
Tales to Astonish, Tales of Suspense.
Journey into Mystery,
some cowboy stuff.
And yeah, naturally they're doing some Westerns. I assume DC's running some Westerns.
DC is running Westerns and sci-fi as well. And, you know, and then you've got EC. It stands for Educational Comics.
Mm-hmm.
And oddly enough, it starts off publishing Bible comics.
Okay.
But then the publisher, William Gaines, realized maybe there's something else we can do here. So they started doing a line of horror and crime comics.
Are they still educational?
Not so. Well, maybe as a how not to get caught. I don't know. But you've got like Tales from the Crypt.
That's where Tales from the Crypt comes from?
Yes.
I love me some
Crime
from
Does
the
Not
Crypt.
Pay, things like that. There's a famous cover. I don't remember which issue it is. But it's a dude standing there with a bloody axe and a woman's head. He's holding it by the hair.
Uh-huh.
I mean,
it as you would.
As
don't want to get your fingers gross.
No, indeed. And her beheaded corpse laying in the corner. Because there were no guidelines. And so you had a couple of different things going on.
So people were pushing some envelopes.
People were pushing some envelopes. And plus there was a guy named Frederick Wortham.
And Frederick Wortham is?
Frederick Wortham was a psychiatrist in New York.
Is he a quack? Does he think that the comics are rotten kids' brains?
Kind of. He did a lot of work with juvenile delinquents. And he noticed that a lot of his patients read comics. Now, we, of course, know that correlation does not
equal causation.
However, he drew a straight causal relationship between comics and juvenile delinquency. Not no studies, no research efforts.
That's why the bad kid's always sneaking a comic book inside of his textbook.
Bingo. But he writes this book called Seduction of the Innocent.
Oh, God.
Inflammatory title.
Ooh.
Okay. And he throws out ideas.
It's basically a misleading tweet. Like, it's the clickbait of the 1950s.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, man.
And he throws out ideas like, you know, like, Batman and Robin is a pedophile's dream because you've got this bare-legged youth hopping around in shorts and this single adult man, and the two of them
live. One of them is where this starts.
Yes, and the two of them live in this big mansion on the hill with another old queen as the butler, you know, and, you know.
No!
Oh, yeah, and so that, in turn.
Do you have a copy of this book?
I do.
Yes! I'm so glad. I have to look through this.
And the Seduction of the Innocent leads to the comic book hearings in the later 50s, led by Senator Estes Kefauver. And Seduction of the Innocent also, you know, brings us the Batman stuff, but also talks about the gore and the crime.
Right, of what's going on with
from EC. And, you know,
as well as the sort of sexualization of sci-fi over happening at every other comic.
Right. And keep in mind that comics were largely for kids.
Right.
You know, so you got kids reading
Barbarella type stuff.
Well, not quite yet.
No, but I mean.
But the sex wasn't graphic, but it was certainly suggestive. The violence, on the other hand.
I was just talking her costume, not necessarily her everything else.
Well, the violence in these comics is gory. It's substantial. It's gory. So the Senate hearings were about that, and Gaines didn't really do himself any favors in his testimony. Because, but
Gaines being the
publisher of EC, right?
Got it.
And I could spend another hour talking about these hearings, but we're going to cut to the chase here. In order to avoid government oversight, the comics industry, the big publishers, DC, Marvel, Archie, EC, you know, and a few others, agreed to self-censorship.
Which is a great precedent because it winds up, you know, helping out with all the stuff when Tipper Gore runs her campaign and with the ESRB with video games,
mm-hmm.
you know, creating a smaller self-contained system where you're allowed to kind of rely on yourself.
To self-monitor.
Self-monitoring helps in those industries, which also eventually came under fire for various implications that adults felt were seducing the innocent.
Right. And so you get the Comics Code Authority, and there were strict guidelines for the Comics Code. Things like criminals couldn't get away with their crime. It placed limits on the kinds of horror stories you could tell. Like, you couldn't have zombies, werewolves, vampires, none of that stuff. So even though you get characters in the 70s like Morbius the Living Vampire in Marvel Comics, well, he was a science vampire, so he wasn't really undead. You know, things like that.
And this is kind of how this is the era that Stan Lee kind of walks into, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He was writing for Atlas at that point. It wasn't Marvel yet.
Right. Because I know I watched a documentary once where he was talking about it, and the point at which he was getting ready to leave was because he was tired of
dealing with
this strict code of authority.
Yeah.
And he wasn't writing what he necessarily wanted to. He was also starting to write romance and things like that because that was easier to get away with, I guess.
Well, romance comics were popular in an attempt to reach a female audience because, of course, women only like romance.
Of course. They also love working in the kitchen and cooking with et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Insert your Truman Show style.
Yeah, so we've got...
Suddenly there's a bunch of rules that they have to abide by.
Right.
And a lot of censorship.
Right. And we are getting into the... And this is all happening at the dawn of the Silver Age, okay? Now, I think I mentioned at the beginning that these ages are largely tied to superhero comics.
Right.
Silver Age is no exception. The Silver Age really kicks off with The Silver Age really kicks off with the publication of Showcase number 4. Now, Showcase was like an anthology title, but not quite like Action had been. Action was an anthology that had multiple features in each issue.
Right.
Showcase had single subject issues, but
they changed regularly. Got it.
Okay, so Showcase 4 gives us the first appearance of the Silver Age Flash, Barry Allen.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Barry was a revamp or reboot, I guess reboot is probably the modern term, of the Golden Age Flash. So 1956, Julius Schwartz, who was a legendary editor, decided, hey, we've got these characters just sitting around that we haven't used in almost 15 years. So let's dust them off, see if we can jazz them up a little bit. And so we get the science fiction-y, Silver Age, Atomic Age. I say Atomic Age in the sense of kind of American culture at the time. Revamp of the Flash. You know, so instead of quote-unquote hard water fumes that powered Jay Garrick, the original Flash, Barry gets his powers from lightning and chemicals. Okay.
Got it. This is where a lot of our radioactive and space chemical superheroes start.
And we're going to see a lot of that in the 60s with Marvel Comics as well.
Right. So our first one, we don't necessarily question our heroes, and a lot of time, and they're not that much more beyond human. And in the Golden Age, you know, we don't necessarily, I mean, Action Comics number 1 doesn't necessarily discuss him being the last son of Krypton, does it?
Yeah, it does, actually. Okay. Most of the comic characters, most of the heroes are humans, Batman, Wildcat, Mr. Terrific.
Even Wonder Woman's, you know, she's got her strength and she's got her...
She's an Amazon. That part...
And she's still powered, from Earth.
Yeah, and powered by the gods of Greek mythology.
Yeah, and there's
a
certain air of mysticism there.
Absolutely.
And then with... I had no idea that they'd mentioned the Krypton thing right off the bat. That's really cool that they jumped in on that right away. I had always assumed he'd kind of loosely found their footing. But
there's a lot of things that kind of come as they progress. In fact, a lot of the elements that we just sort of take for granted from Superman came from the Superman radio show.
Hmm.
Yeah, like the Daily Planet, Kryptonite, Perry White.
Really?
All first show up in the radio.
That's
in the radio
cool.
plays.
Okay, so
but anyway, back
so give and take. So Superman Action Comics number 1 is what year?
1938.
So the end of the Depression, we go into the war, we go through all that time period, we have superheroes that are just a little bit stronger than humans for the most part.
You've got some exceptions. Superman, Wonder Woman,
Captain America.
Yeah.
You know, we've got a few special ones, but not too crazy as far as how they got there. And a little bit more mysticism than sci-fi. And
Like Captain Marvel was straight mysticism.
Oh, yeah.
He gets his powers from the wizard Shazam. So,
And then October 56 comes along. We've got modern day Barry Allen. And suddenly...
And he's aware of the Flash because he reads the Flash comic books.
Nice.
So he reads Jay Garrick comics.
Ah.
Okay.
So does he also have the same explosive, oh my gosh, let's do superheroes again?
The sales for those issues of Showcase, because what DC would do is they would do 3 issues of the feature. You know, they did 3 issues of The Flash. Sales were great. And so Julius was like, hey, let's try something else. How about Green Lantern? So we get Green Lantern.
What?
Yeah, that's cool. So we get Hal Jordan, test pilot, because, you know, the right stuff, Chuck Yeager.
Oh, yeah.
Guys like
that. In that time period.
Yeah.
The space race is on.
Yes. And so, you need a man without fear? Well, you got Hal Jordan, a test pilot.
Nice.
And whereas Alan Scott, the Golden Age Green Lantern's ring was more like a magic wish ring, here it's science. So, and Hal Jordan is part of an intergalactic police force, basically.
Gotcha.
The Guardians of the Universe.
Yeah. And then a year later, we have Sputnik.
Mm-hmm.
Almost like to the day.
Yeah.
Sputnik's in October of 1957.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the point where it's not just, hey, we're racing them to space. It's now,
hey, they're ahead of us.
Yeah, we are in a competition now.
Mm-hmm.
So then Kennedy comes in 61, and what is he talking about in his inauguration speech? Like,
we got to go to space.
We are going to go to the moon. we are going to go to, like, he says it over and over and, mm-hmm. and talks about it. So, like, the whole nation is trying to push us to get us into space, mm-hmm. and the world is watching. Mm-hmm. So we have test pilot, which is awesome. We've got
Barry Allen's a police scientist. Scientists were heroes. Ray Palmer, the Atom, the next one to get revamped, another scientist.
So these characters, the Atom, the Flash, the Green Lantern, they all exist in the Golden Age.
Yeah, they're some like
through the elements of some sort of mysticism initially, and then
well, fuzzy science for let's say. You know, I mean, like...
Because people don't care about science like at right. that point, so Al science
Pratt.
Is crazy.
Exactly. Al Pratt, the Golden Age Atom, he's just a short dude who can punch. And he's got, like... And eventually he acquires, like, this atomic-powered punch, you know? But he's not a scientist, you know?
When do we get Hank Pym?
Not yet.
Okay. So...
Later.
Back to the 50s.
But Ray Palmer, you know, he's a scientist. He figures out that he can use this chunk of white dwarf star... to control his size and his mass. And
white
so we have
star.
I know. And we have the Atom because he can shrink to the size of an atom.
Of course.
So
this is a podcast and he's pushing his fingers very close together. They're not quite touching. They're not. It's very small.
So once we start getting some of these characters, then Julius Schwartz, our editor, says, hey, you know what we really need to do now? We need to revamp the Justice Society. So we get Brave and the Bold 28, another tryout book, Justice League of America.
Okay, so we're not bringing back Justice Society.
Nope.
We're bringing the Justice League of America.
Yes.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it was a huge hit.
Oh, yeah.
It was a phenomenal hit. And because it was such a hit... Martin Goodman, who owned Marvel, said to his nephew, hey, I want a team book like some of their Justice League of America that they got over there across town. And Stan's like, okay, I think I got something.
Does Stan do this?
Yeah. Martin tells Stan. Stan was Martin's nephew.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. He was the boss's nephew. And so he puts together the Fantastic Four. And that's when the Marvel Age of Comics begins.
As he told it in that same documentary I was talking about, mm-hmm. with him being kind of tired of writing, you know, not sure what he could write, the Fantastic Four was kind of the last stop for him.
Mm-hmm.
He said in the documentary, basically, that he had said to his wife, like, I'm tired of writing all these other things. And his wife said, then write what you want to write. If you're going to be leaving mm-hmm. anyway, you might as well do what you're supposed, like what you wanted to do.
Yeah.
And this is like the perfect opportunity. You know, everything comes together. We've got this team dynamic that is being requested and his, you know, wife saying, just write what you want. And what does he love? But like cool team ups and fascinating powers.
Yeah. And it's all science because Reed Richards, Ben Grimm, Susan Storm, and Johnny Storm, they were stealing a rocket because they were racing the Russians to the moon. And so, again, scientist heroes.
Yeah.
Pushing the boundaries of the new frontier.
For sure.
So, the Silver Age lasts up into about 1973.
Okay.
Okay. And there's really a lot of contrast between DC at that time and Marvel at that time. Batman in particular was heavy science fiction, lots of aliens, and the...
Really?
Mm-hmm. And he was very much a good citizen.
Okay.
He was a citizen. Citizen of Gotham. The whole Adam West shtick, you know, well, citizen, you know, think clean thoughts, chum, and all that sort of thing. William Dozier, the producer of the 60s Batman TV show, that's what he was getting from the comics at the time. We laugh about how campy it was and all that, but that's what DC was publishing.
Yeah.
You know, and Superman was hyper-powered and all of this, and he was the establishment at that point.
Yeah.
And Marvel was doing it different. Their heroes had problems. Peter Parker, Spider-Man, worried about how he's going to pay the rent, how he's going to pay for Aunt May's medicine.
Yeah.
Ben Grimm, the thing. I'm a monster. I'm trapped in this monster's body. How am I going to function in this world that's not built for a guy like me?
And you got writers who, for a little while, were writing romance novels, so they know how to deal with the self-loathing and things like that in a comic book and just crank it out.
Exactly.
While three panels later, they're punching the goblin.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
That sounds like a euphemism.
Well, romance can go that way.
Generally speaking, well, okay. While the start of the gold and silver age is pretty, you know, widely acknowledged, when these things end and kind of change is somewhat open to interpretation. Mm-hmm. A lot of people argue that the silver age really ends with in 1973 with Spider-Man 121.
Oh.
The title of our tale, The Night Gwen Stacy Died. Okay. And so for those of you who don't know, well, I'm sure some of you have probably seen Gwen in one of the Spider-Man movies. Gwen was Peter's true love.
She was an intellectual and emotional match.
Yes.
And no matter what happens in the Marvel Universe, unless it is an alternate universe, Gwen doesn't come back. She and Ben, that's like the staple. Gwen doesn't come back, you know, is written on a board somewhere in a Marvel, like, rules of writing Spider-Man.
Yeah, but that event is widely considered to be kind of the end of the innocence. Because the Silver Age, even in Marvel, with its heroes, with real-world problems, there was still an innocence to it.
Yeah, because we're all still following the rules of the comic code authority.
Yeah, exactly.
Guy's not supposed to win.
Right. Well, and he doesn't, but neither does our hero.
And that's that envelope being pushed.
Yeah. You know, and Marvel was pushing the envelope before. There were a couple of issues of The Amazing Spider-Man that they published without the comics code authority. Because of the drug use. They depicted Harry high on pills, and Stan felt that this was a big enough problem for facing young people that he wanted to tell the story about the harmful effects that drugs could have. You know.
Reconnecting back to an earlier part of our conversation.
Sure.
Stan Lee comes in, and I think we would be remiss in the change in comics if we didn't talk about some of the stuff that was happening industry side as well.
Sure.
Stan starts putting notes at the end of the comic books.
Yeah.
And whether this was something that had been going on in comics for a long
time. Are we talking the soapbox?
The editorial page, the soapbox, the whole here's what we think, fan mail, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Does that start with Marvel? Or does that start start with the Silver Age?
Yeah, I mean, like Julius Schwartz, as I mentioned, he was a personality. Mort Weisinger, who edited the Superman books, was a personality. Mm-hmm. And so these guys had a presence on the letters page. Like they would editorially respond to some of the letters. Mm-hmm. Okay. Stan, though, took that to the next level because he managed to make himself the star of the show. The Stan's soapbox editorial, hey guys, it's just me and you. And here's the deal. Here we are. Here's the issues of the day, at least from our comic book perspective.
Yeah. Here's what we may have been trying to say here. Here's mm-hmm. what we, you know, have been concerned about.
Yeah.
You know, it's cool to see that comics are clearly at this point touching on social issues.
Right.
Not Marvel, just, you know, truth, justice in the American way.
Right.
But it's also cool to see that Stan is willing to talk about these issues, then actually address these issues person to person so that items aren't necessarily missed.
Right. So I mentioned that Stan had done the drug story in Amazing Spider-Man.
Right.
DC was doing that too, though. There was a move towards relevance from DC as well. Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams, the Green Lantern, Green Arrow, Hard Traveling Heroes story.
Okay.
That has Green Lantern and Green Arrow teaming up, kind of crossing the country to try and find themselves.
Okay.
You know, part of that storyline was the revelation that Speedy, Green Arrow's sidekick, was a drug addict. Bum, bum, bum.
Not just like a hero.
Yeah.
He's a drug addict.
Snowbirds Don't Fly is the title of the story. And it's a really famous cover. It's Speedy. I know.
How unfortunate for Speedy.
Well, Speedy was created back in the 40s.
Sure.
So But
so are certain drug problems.
It's this.
Sorry.
I see what you did there. But we the cover has in the foreground Speedy. He's got his heroin on the front table, the table in the foreground, and Green Lantern's like, "What about it, GA? Your sidekick's an addict." And it was a big deal. So
I've seen this cover. He's like pointing at him and he's like kind of like, we need to address this. Yeah, this is a big deal.
Exactly.
Now that didn't pass the Comic Code Authority, I imagine, either.
Mm-hmm. It does have the Comics Code Authority seal.
Wow.
Probably because it's viewed as a problem. And while Stan's drug issues in Spider-Man were also treated it as a problem, I think part of the portrayal, the artistic portrayal of the highs and stuff was considered pretty graphic for the time. So
a little grittier, is not how one would normally describe Marvel versus DC.
Well, no, I suppose not. But there's a move from both sides towards more relevant, more adult stories, because part of what's going on behind the scenes is you've got these creators coming up who had been fans as kids.
Yeah.
Guys like Roy Thomas, who took over a lot of Stan's writing duties as the line got bigger at Marvel and eventually succeeded Stan as editor-in-chief.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. You know, Denny O'Neill had been a fan as a kid, and Neil Adams had been a fan. I mean, hell, in the Silver Age, you had 13-year-old Jim Shooter writing Legion of Superheroes. 13 years old.
What?
He was the writer on Legion of Superheroes.
That's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Silver Age. You know, anything can happen. And frankly,
it frequently did.
Well, it frequently did. And that's, I think, kind of the weird paradoxical idea of the 50s. You know, we're done with war. We are all able to afford houses.
It's a new age of American optimism.
Anything can happen. The American dream of I can rise up and I can be somebody, I feel like really finds its footing again. Mm-hmm. After the extravagance of the 20s, we spent two decades punishing everyone for their extravagance in the 20s, because now it's like, no, but we're handling this responsibly now. We have a car and a family and we have our duties and the women have their duties, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with this massive chunk of science that's coming in this, you know, we can go to space.
Yeah.
Suddenly it's not just like I can go grow up to teach or I can grow up to be a policeman. It's, you know, I can grow up to be an astronaut.
Yes.
And now it's, you know, if I'm a test pilot, we're going to space. Maybe an alien race is going to give me a ring that allows me to do anything with the power of my will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what guides the Green Lantern?
Willpower.
Is literally just his willpower.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what gives him his power. And so I think there comes a point where you're going to feel a certain responsibility.
Sure.
When you realize, like, hey, if we've got the eyes and ears of all of these kids, including the ones that are writing for us,
right,
you see what their problems are way more close hand.
Absolutely.
And that's amazing. That's
yeah.
a beautiful time to be for literature.
Right. And it's starting to be viewed that way. Stan was a hugely popular lecturer on the college circuit. Marvel comics were being read in colleges, not necessarily as like curriculum, but certainly by the student body.
Yeah.
DC's kind of coming along behind, you know, because they were a little slow to turn the boat, you know, but they're getting there.
Yeah.
And so we move into the Bronze Age in the 70s, you know.
With a less clear start, but also
Gwen
Stacy.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like there's not...
It's certainly not the explosive start. It's not like, holy
right.
crap, Gwen Stacy died. Let's kill every other person we have that's a side, you know, character.
Right.
Not in the same... It didn't have the same, like, pomp and circumstance, I think, as a start.
No, that is a true statement.
This all being said, there's discrepancies with where the Bronze Age started, which is where we're going anyway, because as soon as the drugs start coming up, that's also kind of considered part of the Bronze Age.
Yeah,
but there's some overlap.
Yeah, it's a move towards more realistic storytelling in some ways.
Right.
You know, you've got Gwen Stacy's death, that kind of thing didn't usually happen.
Right.
You know, you've got the hard traveling heroes over at DC. Okay. There's just not a clear consensus as to when the Bronze Age starts.
Okay.
You know?
So for a lot of people, it starts at 121 because of how
with
dramatic
the death of Gwen Stacy.
Right.
You know, but Another big event is Jack Kirby leaving Marvel in that same year. He leaves Marvel to go to DC. Jack felt like he wasn't getting his due credit.
Well, when Stan is doing circuits and has his own soapbox.
Well, and
people are saying the Excelsior, or they're not saying, Kirby something.
Right. Well, and the way the Marvel method of comic creation really works is Jack and Steve Ditko and the other artists in some ways were doing as much, and I'm putting it in air quotes, writing, as Stan was. Stan and his artists would talk about plot and what's going to happen in the issues. The artists would go off and kind of map it out and draw it, and then Stan would come back in and dialogue it.
Kind of like board-driven cartoons.
Kind of.
I mean, board-driven cartoons, the boarders get to write more dialogue than the writers, but the visual aspect of a board-driven cartoon certainly starts with, hey, this is the story we're kind of going for, here's the idea, and then the boarder is the one who, decides the moments within the thing and the art that's going on.
Sure.
And what basically decides the pacing of the story.
Right.
As well as, how it all looks, because that's their job.
Mm-hmm.
So
plus the other thing is Jack has been trying to get his art back from Marvel, and so there's a big conflict, lots of lawsuits.
And poor Steve's in there, like, kind of being swept under the rug, I feel like. Not a lot of people know Steve Ditko's name like they do Stan and Jack Kirby.
Part of that is by Steve's own wish, because Steve was pretty
against the idea of being a celebrity for
him. He was not interested in being a celebrity. Steve was pretty reclusive by choice.
Okay.
My impression was that it was fairly common knowledge where he lived. Mm-hmm. People would send him requests for interviews. He would politely decline. One interview that he did, and I don't know how true this story is, he went, the interviewer went over.
As legend would have it.
Yes. Went over to interview him and Steve was making lunch and he was using a page of Spider-Man original art as a cutting board for his making his lunch, On the other hand, Steve donated the entire contents of Amazing Fantasy 15, the Spider-Man contents of that Amazing Fantasy 15 to the Library of Congress. So, complicated man.
We have Kirby leaving.
Kirby was one of the architects of the Marvel Universe. Okay. Remember, the Marvel Universe at this point is really a decade, maybe a little bit longer than that, old.
Yeah.
He's been there from the beginning.
15 years tops.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's 73, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And that's 56 is when the whole thing starts in that era. Which,
right.
And they didn't, they're not jumping in.
Well, Jack, Jack was, like we mentioned Will Eisner earlier, Jack Kirby was one of the foundational talents of the comic industry. Much of what Jack has done had done in his lifetime is just other artists are scratching the surface.
Gotcha.
Okay. But Jack moves to DC and we get the Fourth World Saga. The New Gods, Orion, Darkseid.
This is when things get really convoluted in the DC universe and dark.
Well, I don't know how convoluted they get, because Jack's original intent with the Fourth World Saga was to tell a largely self-contained story. Part of the deal for him going to DC was that he'd be left alone to do the books and tell the story that he wanted to tell.
Yeah.
He ends up on Superman's pal, Jimmy Olsen, as part of this Fourth World stuff, and they redraw his Superman faces because they thought he was too off model. It's like, bro, you're going to redraw Jack Kirby?
Oh, man.
So there was a lot going on.
Yeah. So with all that happening industry-wise, mm-hmm. and then with the tone of comics going towards drugs just a couple years prior.
Well, not just going towards heavy... More realistic.
Realistic problems.
Right. You've got Luke Cage, in the 70s dealing with poverty and crime in the urban cities, which mm-hmm. I guess is redundant. But he was dealing with crime in ways that Spider-Man wasn't.
Right. And he was dealing with different types of crime.
Yes.
And he was in prison.
Yeah, he was a former criminal.
Yeah.
So.
And so, wrongfully accused or rightfully accused, the man served time, and then a corrupt prison guard, is largely responsible for what happens in the accident in mm-hmm. their attempt to
to silence him.
Yeah, in his attempt to silence him, and it ends up making him a stronger person.
It ends up making Luke Cage a hero.
Yeah.
Or giving him the tools to become
a hero. Tools to become a hero. He still has to choose.
Yes.
Right? Which mm-hmm. is beautiful in its own right. But you've mm-hmm. got comics with not just, you know, you're
looking for trends.
I'm saying you have comics not just dealing with serious issues, but you have them dealing with issues that are kind of race related.
Oh yeah.
And we've just left the civil rights movement.
Left probably isn't the right way to put that, but these are definitely a response to things that were going on at the time.
Yeah.
So
yeah. So the so at this point when we realize that the age of sci-fi and big dreams is not without its fair share of problems, when we start discussing those problems is right around the point where things kind of shift to bronze.
Yes.
It's certainly not as pretty as silver.
No, that's true.
Which is a good way to remember that, I think. Yeah.
Oh, that is nice. I like that. Over at DC, you've got the Teen Titans dealing with kind of the youth movement mm-hmm. and youth culture, which is weird because the guy writing them, Bob Haney, was a much older man and B, certainly out of touch.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, that's where you get the dialogue like, hey, Twinkle Toes, let's put the shake in it, blah, blah. Yeah, it's pretty funny to go back and read some of those. But in terms of the storylines,
they're trying to talk about some serious
stuff. Yeah, they're trying to talk about it.
Without it being too heavy either. I mean, yeah. We still have a crazy bad guy who's mm-hmm. largely in part going to lose every single time because that's the rules. You know,
well, or at least doesn't get a permanent victory,
right? So. The comic code authority.
Mm-hmm.
When do we start seeing their fizzling?
Oh, not until the 90s.
We've still got the Bronze Age with all of these serious issues.
Oh, absolutely.
At some point, well, I mean, we're self-regulated.
Yeah.
So it's not like the government's jumping in to say, "Hey, stop this." We've been pushing the envelope bit by bit to the point where we know these serious issues
mm-hmm.
can be addressed.
And, well, but they're not all serious, I mean, you've got, for every serious issue that's being addressed, you've still got Spider-Man fighting Doc Ock.
Yeah.
Or the Justice League fighting off an invasion of Martians.
When does Dr. Octopus come in? Because Dr. Octopus is also a somewhat righteous scientist. Does he start off with his goal to be better and he's corrupted by power, or is he a little bit more just evil scientist?
Doc Ock first shows up in Amazing Spider-Man number 3.
Oh,
so wow. Super early.
I assume that's in the late 50s.
That is 1963.
Oh, Spider-Man doesn't come out until the 60s? Spider-Man's as old as Doctor Who.
Yeah.
I always thought...
A little bit older.
I could say I always thought, but I figured Spider-Man had started a little sooner.
Fantastic Four came out in 61.
Oh, okay.
So.
And that's really the beginning of the Marvel
yeah.
superhero era. Right. Okay, cool.
There you go.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Make sure to give us a rating, subscribe, and...
Tell all your friends to listen to the podcast, and if you didn't like it... Tell all your enemies.
Yeah. Once again, thank you so much to Dave Ziegler for letting us into the vault of knowledge that is his brain. We really appreciate all the time and effort he puts into making sure that we have all the facts as straight as possible on this podcast. So, and if you've got any questions for us, please head us up on Twitter or Instagram at Sneaky Geek Pod and at Sneaky Geek Podcast. Or leave us a review. We'd love to hear what you have to think, and we'd really appreciate it. Also, shout out to our listeners in Panama. That's super cool. As well as in Argentina, Greece, Denmark, Australia, and Chile. That's super cool that we have listeners overseas now. I'm so excited about that. So please let us know what you think and shoot us a review or shoot us a tweet. Seriously, we'd love to hear from you guys. Thank you so much.